hoping you noticed this painting up here. Some of you have seen it before. Many of you probably haven't. It usually hangs in the church office. It was painted by somebody who was sitting in the park looking at the church, and that's what they saw. And it is one of my favorite things in this entire building, is that painting. It speaks to me about things that I imagine Walmer is and could be on so many different levels. And I don't know if it speaks to you at all, but I'm going to leave it up here, not in the office, as long as I have permission to do that, for the duration of the next couple of months when we're talking about imagining church. When you hear the word imagination, what do you think of? Dreaming. Something made up? Reminiscing? Okay, scary. Newness? An image in the mind? There are lots of things when we hear that word. Some of the things that I thought of: creativity, picturing things in your mind, daydreaming, imaginary friends. Did any of you have an imaginary friend when you were a child? Maybe you don't want to admit it. I had these friends. They had a daughter, and when she was really little, she had an imaginary friend, but she wasn't satisfied with just an imaginary friend. And I remember going to visit her, and she introduced me to her entire imaginary family who lived on an imaginary farm. So she pointed out all the farm animals that lived on the imaginary farm. It was truly delightful. I have a picture of a painting, David, if you can bring that one up. This is by a woman named Daria Sherba, called Close the Light, We're Eating Pasta. And I don't know, it's not very vibrant, but if you can kind of see, it's a really weird painting. And so when I think about imagination, I think about artists who are just weird. You don't even know where on earth they could have come up with something like that painting. And so if other painters like Salvador Dali, if you Google him, or Picasso's another one, just imagination to the extreme. I think about writers like J.R.R. Tolkien and the Lord of the Rings trilogy and The Hobbit, and how he came up with entire different kinds of people and a different world and all of those things. All of those things are things that I think of when I think of imagination. There are different things that contribute to our ability to imagine. One of the primary things are our own memories. There's a guy who works at Carleton University. He's actually the director of something called the Science of Imagination Laboratory. And he said that memories are the fuel of imagination. Imagination is about all of the ways that we know things and understand things and experience things, all being connected in our brains in different and new ways. If you want to improve your imagination, if you think it's not scary and so you want to improve your imagination, read things, look at art, try doing different things, going different places, exposing yourself to new kinds of experiences. In other words, we just have to grow our knowledge, grow our understanding, expand the experiences that we're having in the world and with the world's people, and all of that contributes to our imagination. But there are also things that can constrain our imagination, can kind of hold it, contain it, hold it down a little bit. And so right off, one of the primary things that can get in the way of our ability to imagine is lack of experience or not knowing things or understanding things. So as an example, before my mom died, I couldn't truly imagine what I would experience when she died. And that's because even though I knew things about grief and I knew things about death, I'd walked alongside lots of people who had lost a parent. I had never experienced that loss myself. And so having no experience, no like-minded experience to draw upon, it wasn't actually possible for me to imagine what that would be like. Another of the things that constrains our imagination would be the rules of things or the way things are. So if you're ever in a session and you're kind of brainstorming things and you hear, we've we tried that, we failed, or we've never done it that way before. What we're saying is there are rules, this is outside the rules, and so you can't start imagining down that pathway. Think about this, at one time, it was impossible to imagine what it would be like to fly. The way our bodies are designed mean that the closest we can come to flying is falling or running really fast, maybe. But that's really the closest we can come to getting a sense of what it's like to fly. And then in the 1800s, a man named George Cayley designed the very first glider that used a person's body to control it. And there was a little boy, his name's been lost in history, who was the very first person to try that glider and experience what it was to fly. And he was the only person for a while in the whole world who could truly imagine what it was like to fly. A year ago, if you had asked, "There's no way that I could imagine that I'd be making lunch for all of us every week." That's because, as a rule, the way things are, I don't cook much at all, never mind for other people. So if you'd said, "Imagine making lunch for 24, 30 people every week," I'd be like, "I can't, it's an impossibility. It's I can't even imagine." Now, over the next couple of months, we're going to be invited to imagine church. It might be a weird kind of way to think about church. Don't we already know what church is? We're here. We're at church. We are the church. This is a church building. We maybe think we already know all of these things. But at Walmer, we're in the early stages of becoming a new church, possibly a new kind of church, at least for some of us. There's a small team that's been talking about and learning over the last 3 years all sorts of things about this new church. We've been part of a course that's been designed specifically for struggling churches to aid in their revitalization. We've learned things. We've been really intentional about listening for God's insight and direction. We've tried new things and then reflected on the things that we've tried. One of the things that's been really clear to that small team is that Jesus' promise in Matthew 16, his promise that he would build his church, is a promise for Walmer. And I, for one, I take great comfort in that promise, especially as we've seen evidence of its truth, particularly over this last year. But here's the thing about how God works. Almost always, God chooses to work with us rather than for us. When Jesus promised to build his church, he wasn't saying to his disciples, "Okay, you guys all just sit back and have dinner together and wait, because I'm going to do this amazing thing." He said, "I'm going to do this amazing thing with you and through you." And the disciples, the first ones, the ones that came after, still today, traveled the world to talk about and to live out the good news of God's kingdom. They didn't just sit back and wait for Jesus to do it all. They were part of it, because that's the way God works. God works with us, not really always for us just. There are exceptions to that. There are times when God just does these incredible miracles that we have nothing to do with. I believe that Jesus promised to build a new Walmer. But I also believe that we are his crew in that building. We're the ones who are responsible for listening to him, for following his lead, for allowing ourselves to be shaped however he would shape us. And the first thing that we need to do is to allow our imaginations to run a little bit wild, to imagine Walmer not just as it's been, or as we think it should be, or as some other church we've experienced has been, but to imagine what it could be. And so over the next couple of months, we're going to be doing this in a few different ways. We're going to be engaging in scripture as we always do, asking it to help us imagine church. We're also going to be hearing from a few other preachers over the coming weeks who are going to share some of what they imagine when they imagine church. And so next week, Tanya Ewan, who used to work at Walmer, she's going to be here and she'll be preaching. And then a couple weeks after that, somebody and somebody. And the third thing we're going to be doing is asking God to help us understand what are the rules that constrain our imaginations when it comes to imagining church, helping us differentiate between those rules that he wants left in place and those the ones that are heard through the filter of we've never done it that way before or that's not the right way. So differentiating between those rules and those that he would have us toss out the window. Some rules are important, and the imagination has to be somewhat constrained. But other rules get in the way of us imagining what it is that God is creating here. And so as part of this, today we're going to be looking at a passage from Matthew. It's in Matthew 18. It's from verses 15 to 20. And I'm going to encourage you to follow along in the Bible near you or on your phone, or if you brought one, whatever you have with you, to be able to follow along in reading that. And when we go through this scripture, I'm looking at it through the lens of imagining church, but it also speaks to us at an individual level. So let's not miss out on what it is, not just that God is saying to us, but to God, what God might be saying to you or to me as we listen to these words. And so again, it's from Matthew 18, and I'm reading from 15 to 20. And this is how it reads. It's not really the first thing that you would think about in a series called Imagining Church. If your brother or sister sins against you, go and point out the fault when the two of you are alone. If you're listened to, you have regained that one. But if you are not listened to, take one or two others along with you so that every word may be confirmed by the evidence of two or three witnesses. If that person refuses to listen to them, tell it to the church. And if the offender refuses to listen even to the church, let such a one be to you as a Gentile and a tax collector. Truly I tell you, whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. Again, truly I tell you, if two of you agree on earth about anything you ask, it will be done for you by my Father in heaven. For where two or three are gathered in my name, I am there among you. I have to say that last verse, those last words, where two or three are gathered in my name, when we first started meeting back here in person, after a couple years of meeting just on Zoom, sometimes there would only be two or three of us, and it was huge comfort to know that Jesus said, where two or three are gathered, I'm there. So it was all good. Is there anybody in this room who's comfortable with conflict? Probably not. If there is, I think there might be something wrong with you, or you're just way more mature than I am in that area. But conflict is uncomfortable. By its very nature, conflict is uncomfortable. It's so much easier to just avoid it. It's so much easier to just pretend that it's not there. The problem is that when we pretend it's not there, or whenever we avoid a conflict, it festers. It doesn't go away. It grows roots, it burrows under the surface and wraps itself around everything it finds. It infects good things and it destroys healthy things. There was a couple who had been divorced, and it was a pretty ugly, nasty divorce. And only one part of the couple stayed going to the church, but both sets of parents were in the church. And they continued to go to the church for years and years. No one talked about it. It was a really wide sanctuary, and so the two sets of parents each sat on opposite sides of the sanctuary. They came in and left the church through different doors on Sunday mornings. They ignored each other completely and pretended there was nothing wrong. That's the kind of stuff that festers and infects and destroys. Another way that we might choose to deal with conflict is to fight back, to do whatever we have to do to win, because that's how we often think of conflict, isn't it? It's a contest, and there has to be a winner and a loser. And sometimes we have lines that we won't cross in order to win, but other times we'll do whatever we have to win in this conflict because we can't stand the idea of losing. This is the kind of conflict that demands that people take sides. It's the kind of conflict that rips apart the fabric of a community. It's nowhere near as subtle as the avoiding and the pretending it doesn't exist kind of conflict. And when the dust settles after the fight is over, it's always clear that there aren't actually any winners at all. I knew a family that split apart because of an argument over an inheritance, and this happened years and years and years ago, and they still don't speak to each other. Jesus demands a different way of his people, of his followers. I imagine that if we could just fight well in churches, because as our relationships build, as we grow closer to each other, as our church grows in health, there will be times that we disagree. There will be conflicts. If we could learn to fight well, fight in a way that is Jesus' way, what an extraordinary testimony to the rest of the world that would be. In verse 15 of this passage in Matthew 18, Jesus said, "If a brother or a sister sins against you, go and point out the fault when the two of you are alone." If a brother or sister sins against you, go to the one who sinned against you. Not to somebody else, to the person who sinned against you. There's this thing in conflict resolution in psychology called triangulation. And so if you think that you have a person at the top of the triangle and a person over here, and there's a conflict there, and they don't want to talk about each other. Sometimes some of us who can't stand that there's a conflict there, we become the third point in the triangle, and we talk to that person, and we talk to that person, and we become, we think, the mediator or the intermediary to help it all along. But what we're actually doing is making it so that these two people don't have to talk to each other. But that's the very first thing Jesus said. If somebody sins against you, go to that person. Not to everybody else, it doesn't mean it's you can't go to somebody and ask for advice, but go to that person. Also, go and point out the fault when the two of you are alone. When I read that, I think, we're supposed to actually assume the best of the person. Assume that that other person doesn't actually even know that they've sinned against us. Could you imagine if we entered every conflict with the assumption that, they don't know that they've hurt me. I need to go and let them know. Instead of, how dare they? I can't believe they treated me like that. I can't believe they hurt me like that. So Jesus is saying, go to that person and let them know that they've hurt you, that they've sinned against you. There was a woman in my old church who overheard me say something on a Sunday after church, and for years was angry at me. I didn't know she was angry at me. I didn't know until it all blew up one day. And when I found out, and we sat down to talk it through, and I found out she was mad about this thing that she'd heard me say years ago, it turned out I hadn't actually said what she thought I'd said. Imagine if she had just come and said, "You know what, Elaine? Yesterday or last week, I heard you say this thing, and it really makes me angry, or it really hurts me, or whatever." I could have said, "I didn't say that. This is what I said." Years of better relationship. Years that I could have been her pastor, that I wasn't able to be her pastor. The other thing we hear in this is point out the fault when you're alone. Don't let it become a spectacle. Don't stand up in the middle of a Sunday service and start yelling at the person across the room. Go to the person yourself. Assume that they don't actually know that they've harmed you, and do it when you're alone, so it's not a spectacle for everybody else. Now, here's a caveat to that. Sometimes it's not safe to be alone with a person who's harmed you, a person who sinned against you. And so in those situations, be aware of that. Have the conversation in a coffee shop. Or in those situations, you might need somebody else with you. And so there are always exceptions to these kind of things. But essentially, I think what Jesus is saying is, don't make it be a big spectacle, a big show for everybody to see. And then Jesus continues, if you're listened to, you've regained that one. But if you're not listened to, Then take one or two others with you so that every word may be confirmed by the evidence of two or three witnesses. See, this isn't, it's not about bullying the person. It's not about shaming the person. It's not about ganging up against the other person. When we're hurt, it's really hard to listen. We need sometimes other people to be able to listen for us and to listen to us. I was involved in a conflict. You're gonna think all I do is fight with people. I really don't. But I was involved in a conflict with a couple other ministers at one point, and it didn't go. Yeah, it was very hurtful and harmful and all sorts of things. And the day came when the three of us needed to sit at a table and have a full-on conversation. And I took a friend with me. I didn't take a friend with me because there were two of them and one of me. I kind of did, but not just because of that. I took a friend with me because I knew that I needed an interpreter in that conversation. I needed somebody who could help me understand what they were saying and who could maybe help them understand what I was saying, because I wasn't going to be at my best in my communication. And so somebody else to be there to help with all of that communication, help get this to a place of resolution. And I'm thankful to say we got to a place of resolution as much as was possible in this particular situation. And I'm forever grateful for my friend Jim, who went with me to that conversation. We also may need someone else to advocate with the other person for us, especially if we aren't being heard. This is a thing that a lot of women have experienced, that sometimes our voices are ignored just because we're women. Or some of you have been ignored because of the color of your skin. Or some have been ignored because we don't dress the right way or we don't talk the right way or whatever. There's all sorts of reasons that other people might not choose to listen to us. And so sometimes we need to take one or two or three other people with us so that we will be heard. In verse 17, Jesus says, if that person refuses to listen to them, then tell it to the church. Oh, that one. I don't like that one. I wish Jesus had left that part out altogether here. Because the danger in my mind is if, oh my goodness, if this goes out to the whole church, it becomes a whole big thing that I don't really want it to be. There was, again, another, this happens in a lot of churches, but you have a lead pastor, you have an associate pastor, and some people really love the lead and some people really love the associate, and somebody assumes that there's something, and you end up getting two camps in the church. You get this person's camp and this person's camp, and they fight against each other, and sometimes the pastors have had something to do with it, sometimes they've had nothing to do with it. It's all been imagined slights and fights and whatever's going on. But it becomes this great big huge church thing. And the church splits apart. The church doesn't survive it. But what if a church was built on healthy relationships to start with? There's a writer, I don't even know if he's still alive. His name is Scott Peck, and he's written a lot of things in the area of psychology and church community and things like that. And he differentiates between two kinds of community. He says there's the community where you all say, we like each other, we're very friendly, we value harmony and getting along above all else. And if you get in the way of that harmony and getting along, then we're going to silence you, we're going to kick you out, we're going to do whatever we have to maintain that harmony. And he says that's not actually real community, that's pseudo-community. Or pretend community. He said, real community, you won't always all get along. Real community, you actually value the relationships more than you value the harmony and the getting along. You value the relationships so much that you are committed to engaging with each other, not just walking away. You're committed to going to the person one-on-one, to taking a couple others with you if it gets to that point. And you're committed as a church to work it through together to a place of reconciliation, of restitution, of whatever has to happen, because the relationships are more important than anything else. Can you imagine a church in which the relationships are such that the community can gather around a conflict, confront the one who's done wrong, and remain strong. Can you imagine that kind of church? For some of us, we can't. We have no experience with that kind of conflict, with those kinds of relationships. Some of you can imagine that kind of a church. And Jesus says about the one who refuses to listen, let such a one be to you as a Gentile and a tax collector. Notice what he doesn't say. He doesn't say, if that person refuses to listen to the whole church, kick him out, get rid of him. Instead, he said, treat them like a tax collector and a Gentile. Well, when I think about tax collectors and Gentiles, tax collectors, I think about Zacchaeus, who was hanging out to see Jesus as he was passing by, and Jesus pulls him out of the crowd, and he says, guess what? I'm coming to your place for dinner tonight. Zacchaeus is like, oh, that's, you're a holy man. I'm the worst. I'm nothing. And all the people watching were like, he's nothing. You can't go into his home. You will sully yourself. This is an awful thing to do. And Jesus went in, and he loved this man, and this man's life was transformed. And people who knew this man, their lives were transformed because of it. That's how Jesus treated a tax collector. That's how Jesus treats the Gentiles as well, the non-chosen people, the non-Jewish people. Let such a one, the one who refuses to listen, be to you as a Gentile and a tax collector. So a brother or sister, he doesn't just mean like literal brothers and sisters, but the people we're in relationship to in the church. If a brother or sister sins against you, what do? You go and talk to them about it. If they don't listen, you try again, this time bringing one or two other people with you. If they still don't listen, you invite the church to get involved. And if they still don't listen, you love them like Jesus loves, and you keep praying for them for restoration. And then Jesus moves into verse 18 with what sounds like a complete change of subject, but maybe it isn't. I don't think it really is. And here's what he says in verse 18. Truly, I tell you, whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. We heard words like those a couple weeks ago, for those of you who were here, when Jesus asked the disciples, hey, who do people say that I am? And then he asked the disciples, who do you think that I am? And Jesus said, oh, you're the Messiah. And Jesus followed up with a similar statement about binding and loosing. And in that context, it seemed that Jesus was talking about the power to block people from the kingdom or to make the kingdom accessible to people based on the way we act and the way that we speak. And I wonder if maybe he means the same thing here, a similar kind of a thing here. In the context of conflict, whether it's resolved conflict or not resolved conflict, perhaps what he's saying is that when we deal with conflict well, when we deal with conflict as a community that's committed to being in relationship with each other, we are binding those forces that seek to rip apart the church, and we're freeing up people to be truly the church. This is what Jesus says next. Beginning at verse 19, again, truly I tell you, if two of you agree on earth about anything you ask, it'll be done for you by my Father. For where two or three are gathered in my name, I am there among you. Consider the context of the words. He's talking about our relationships with each other, about our community as a church. When I read this, I'm reminded all of the above, of going one-on-one, of bringing along others, of taking it to the whole church, of figuring out how to love well, even if it doesn't end well. All of it must be done under the umbrella of prayer, because it's God that changes hearts. We can't change anybody's hearts. It's God that changes minds. We don't change somebody else's mind. It's God who makes reconciliation possible. It's God who actually restores relationship and restores community. What would our church be like if we seriously committed to taking every single hurt, every single offense, every sin against us to God, and then with God followed the steps that Jesus outlined? Can you imagine that kind of a church? Can you imagine being part of that kind of a church? It might be a scary thing for you to imagine, but that's why Jesus' words, his last words here, are so important. Where two or three are gathered in my name, I am there among us. Where two or three of us are gathered in Jesus' name, he is here among us. Can you imagine that kind of a church? Can you imagine being part of that kind of a church.